I want you to think about what you eat in times of uncertainty. Depending on where you grew up, it could be meatloaf, grilled cheese, maybe it's grits. Comfort food. And in a fascinating study that came out this spring, researchers traced our love of comfort food to feeling safe when we were kids. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, we're doing a show that's kind of the economic equivalent of comfort food. Markets have been very down, very up, very volatile. A lot of us have been worried about retirement or savings, so we've got some comfort food for you. Reasons not to panic, explanations of how China's economy does and doesn't intersect with ours, a look at what else is driving this uncertainty, and reminders that while this week may have felt bumpy, this is not 2008. You can tell us what comforts you in times of uncertainty at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to start with the crazy moves in the stock market, because it's not every week that the Dow opens with a 1,000-point drop. To understand exactly what was happening and how it's linked to the rest of the world, I'm joined by Patty Hirsch. He is the host of our online video explainer series, The Marketplace Whiteboard. Welcome back, Patty.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, let's rewind to the beginning of the week, to Monday. Markets opened, and oh my goodness, a 1,000-point dive. The Dow closing down 588 points. That was the steepest drop since August of 2011. What happened?
Well, before we get into what happened, let's just get a little bit of a reality check here. So that 588-point drop in the market, that's 3.5%. People were calling this Black Monday. All right, Black Monday in 1987 was a 22% drop in the Dow. So this 3.5% drop, it's peanuts. It's like, it's small potatoes, fingerling potatoes, all right? It's tiny.
Yeah, but 3.5%, come on, 3.5% is nothing to sneeze at.
Okay, yeah, it's nothing to sneeze at. But sneeze is a really, really good word, because this brings us to China, right? The reason this happened was because people saw what happened in China and freaked out a little bit. And people say, have this expression, you know, whenever China sneezes, everybody catches a cold. I actually think this is the other way around now. It's like, now, when China catches a little bit of a cold, which it looks like it might have, then we sneeze a little bit. And that's what happened. Monday was like it was a 3.5% sneeze. All right, now, so why is that? What happened? Well, people panicked a little bit, right? Because what happened in China the previous week was that the government started to intervene, not just in the stock market, but in the economy, to try and juice growth over there, because it heard that, oh my gosh, growth might be as low as 6.7%. We'd rather it was closer to 7%. So let's see what we can do to sort of juice things a little bit. That messed with the markets. The markets fell. And then, of course, people started to worry a little bit. Oh, my gosh, maybe, you know, this is going to contribute to a global growth slowdown, not just a slowdown in China. Oh, this is going to impact the U.S. Panic, panic, panic. Everybody pulls money out of the markets.
Some of that is obviously interpreting Chinese moves, because it's hard to get a full handle on what's happening in the Chinese economy. But when you saw the repercussions in the U.S. markets, we bounced around. Tuesday was down. Wednesday, things were better. You know, how real is this? Are we talking a mirage or real market movement?
No, this is real market movement. And, I don't want to make light of this. You know, there are problems in China, and those problems are real. There is a slowdown in the Chinese economy, and that is going to have impact beyond China, particularly on emerging economies that are dependent on their relationship with China. And we're starting to see a lot of kind of warning signs. You know, there's a lot of sort of red lights blinking on the global economic tableau, if you like. You know, we've got the China stock market down. China's economy is slowing. We see a glut in commodities because China's buying less metals and those kinds of things. And that has impact on those other economies. We've got low oil prices, which also has an effect. So, you know, these things are real. And whenever these things happen to the global economy, it does have an impact on corporations that are traded in the U.S. markets, because a lot of these corporations are global corporations that have wide exposure, not just to China, but to other markets. So people look at that and they see the problems that there are around the world, and they say, you know, maybe the projection that we had for those companies going forward was a little bit overbaked. Maybe we were a little bit over-optimistic. Optimistic. You know what? It's time for us to correct our appreciation of where those companies are going to be in 6 months to a year. So let's pull ourselves back a little bit. Let's replace our bets and start all over again. And that is called a correction, which is what we have. People have corrected their view of where these companies and where the market is going to be in 6 months to a year.
The markets and investors have been pricing in the possibility of an interest rate hike by the Fed in September. Do you think we're still on pace for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, people are really split on this. Some people say that the only reason that Janet Yellen and the Fed would want to increase rates is because of the jobs numbers. And we all know that there are flaws with those job numbers, that they mask a lot of the reality behind the unemployment situation in the U.S. A lot of other people say, well, look, the Fed has got to do something, right? I mean, it's been talking about an interest rate hike for some time. If it decides not to do this, then there's a credibility issue there. I actually think that it will raise rates. I think it's a smart thing to do to actually increase interest rates a little bit right now. The correction that we saw this week in the markets, that's kind of a part of that. People have said, well, you know, if we see less easy money sloshing around the world thanks to low interest rates, it's going to mean that there's less demand for assets, which includes stocks, which is going to let some air out of that market. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, as we've already said.
Whatever happens next, we'll have you back to explain it. Patty Hirsch is our resident explainer and hosts the video series, The Marketplace Whiteboard. Thanks, Patty.
Thanks, Lizzie.
We're explaining what's been going on and what it means this week. And in our conversation with Patty, we touched on a few of those factors: psychology, China, oil, and the interconnectivity of our world. We'll take a deeper look at all of that and more throughout the show. Patty mentioned, a lot of the uncertainty in the stock market this week began with worries about what was happening in China. The Chinese economy is incredibly important to ours and to others around the world. But because it's managed by the central government, it can be a little hard to get a clear picture of what's going on. Clayton Duby, director of USC's U.S.-China Institute, is here to explain. Thanks for coming on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
If you don't follow the Chinese economy, or I guess maybe even if you do, this week has been scary. What's happening? Can you translate it to kind of basic principles for me?
I can give it a try. what has been going on for about 5, 6, maybe 7 years is that China has been responsible for the bulk of the economic growth worldwide. And that's because the economic engine of China has been humming along when, for part of that time, the American economy was sputtering in the great financial crisis. And so China has been driving the world economy. And then about a year and a half ago, the Chinese economy began to slow. And despite that slowing, Chinese investors have poured into the stock market, driving valuations really quite high. And then, about a month and a half, 2 months ago, they began to pull out. And over the last 10 weeks or so, the market has dropped by 42%. The Chinese government tried to prop things up, but ultimately it seems it's decided to let market forces guide this. And so the Chinese stock market, which is not a good barometer of the health of the Chinese economy, fell dramatically, and Americans and other investors followed suit.
Why do you say that the Chinese stock market is not a good barometer of their economy?
Because the valuations are just completely irrational. Even after this big sell-off on the Chinese equivalent of the NASDAQ, valuations are still over 38. The price-to-earnings ratio, meaning the what you have to pay to get a dollar of expected earnings, is still 38 to 1, which is twice that of the S&P 500 and is about where tech valuations were at the time of the dot-com bubble in the United States. And so if you went back just a couple of months, that same index, the price-to-earnings ratios, were over 90. There was just no connection with economic fundamentals, with whether or not these companies were hiring, whether or not they were finding customers, whether or not they were making money.
One of the things that we've seen in the past few years and that our correspondent in China, Rob Schmitz, has reported on is the building of a lot of projects within China fueled by debt. You know, these ghost cities that we have seen, or airports that, you know, don't really have flights to anywhere. Do we have a sense of what kind of economic activity is really happening right now in China and whether it's real? That is, whether it's, you know, not sustained just by debt or not built up by the government?
The Chinese economy is growing, and it's important to keep that in mind. And it's probably growing at least as fast as the American economy. But it's not growing at the breakneck pace that many people have grown accustomed to. Over the last quarter century, China has averaged double-digit growth. And that, beginning in 2007, China's prime minister was even saying was unsustainable and unbalanced. And so for a number of years, the Chinese government has been pushing to rebalance this economy. The restructuring of the Chinese economy, it's difficult. It's like turning an oil tanker. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort, and the progress may be just incremental, and then making adjustments on the way is difficult.
When you think about a regular Chinese citizen, do they have the cash and the kind of confidence in their employment to transition the economy to a more consumer-based system?
One of the things that we have seen is that Chinese consumers are buying. They have been purchasing goods. And one of the things that we've seen with regard to investors is, especially smaller investors, is that they're largely locked out of the property market. There's no means for which for them to buy an apartment because housing has become so incredibly expensive in China. But as of about a year ago, still only about 15% of household savings were invested in stocks. Most of what people have been doing with their money has been, you know, consumption. They have partly had to do this because rents, mortgages, all of that has gone up. Food prices have gone up. The cost of living in China has been rising. You've seen factory closures. You've seen some factories that have relocated to Vietnam, to Indonesia, to other lower cost manufacturing centers.
Clayton Duby, director of the USC US-China Institute. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
We're wrapping our heads around the uncertainty in the markets over the last week or so. But before we get back to that, here's digital producer Tony Wagner and Marketplace Weekend producer Raghu Manavalan with a look at some of the other economic stories of the week by the numbers. Our first number being
$100,000.
It's how much it could cost you to use the Happy Birthday song in a movie. You could even get slapped with a fine for performing it in public.
A lot of people assume Happy Birthday is in the public domain, but the copyright is actually held by Warner Chappell Music.
That's why when you go to TGI Fridays, they sing their own birthday song for you.
$23,000.
That's how many foreclosed homes remain on Cook County's backlog, sitting empty in the suburbs of Chicago.
It's a great opportunity to buy into a nice neighborhood, but it's also a chance for opportunists,
that is, squatters,
to move into these so-called zombie homes.
Police recently arrested four men for taking over 14 homes and living in them or renting them out.
One day.
That's how long you'll have to get a McWhopper if Burger King's sincere proposal goes through.
The chain recently asked arch nemesis McDonald's to join hands in burger buns next month for the International Day of Peace.
The King's proposal was delivered via a full-page newspaper ad and promised that the fruits, proceeds of the union would go to charity.
McDonald's CEO politely declined.
Tony, how many McWhoppers would you eat if it meant ending all war?
Honestly, I would eat a few even if it just meant ending, like, one war.
Earlier about what's happening in U.S. markets and about what's happening inside the Chinese economy. And of course, those things are intertwined. Markets in Europe, Asia, and Africa all bounced around this week, too. In such a globally linked economy, we end up depending on other countries in ways we probably couldn't have imagined 50 years ago. Rana Faruhar writes about globalization as a columnist for Time magazine. She's also an assistant managing editor there. We asked her to come on and talk about this web of interconnected economies. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So we have you here to draw a link between China and the nervousness that we have seen in U.S. stock markets. We talked earlier about the Chinese economy on the show. And one of the things I want to know, when you think about global investors, how susceptible are we right now to weakness in the Chinese economy or a sell-off on the Chinese stock markets?
Well, it's interesting. I would say we're very susceptible to the first, but not so susceptible to the second, although this week's market action would have you think the opposite. I always like to say, no matter what country you're talking about, what's happening in the markets is not necessarily what's happening on Main Street and in the real economy.
Definitely.
And what you saw this week with this huge plummeting of the China markets was actually the echo of something much, much bigger that stretches all the way back to the U.S. to 2008, to the financial crisis here. Back then, as we all remember, we stopped spending. Companies and consumers alike buttoned up. Everyone tried to get their balance sheets in order to get back in the black. So we weren't spending. So somebody else had to pick up that slack. And that somebody was China. And so the government started this massive stimulus program cooking up what is really the biggest debt bubble in history. And the market plummet you saw today was the visual part of that, the popping of that bubble. But there's a lot going on underneath that's actually a much bigger deal in terms of China's growth slowing down for the U.S. economy.
You have written in your column over the last couple of years about maybe a decline in globalization. Hmm. Although I wonder, given how interlinked everything feels right now, is that accurate? I mean, how do we even define globalization right now?
Well, you know, globalization is commonly defined as the free flow of capital, people, and goods. And a lot of people predicted post-2008 that that was just going to go off a cliff and collapse. And that didn't happen, to be fair. But I think what has happened is you've seen regionalization. You've seen money and investors being sort of scared, sticking closer to home. You've seen protectionism that's happened in Europe. And it's also happened in China. Now, in terms of how susceptible the U.S. is, again, to the Chinese market, they have a ring-fenced banking system. They have a ring-fenced financial system. So this isn't like a Lehman Brothers moment where, you know, bad debt is going to ricochet from Iowa to Iceland and back or something like that. But China has made up the biggest chunk of global growth in the last decade. And that's new. That was always the role that the U.S. had. And so when they slow down, it matters a lot for all of us.
Does it matter differently, do you think, where you are in the world? You know, are the reverberations in Europe going to be significantly different than they are here when we, you know, think about the next couple of years?
That's a great question. Europe has actually become a key trading partner of China. And China, interestingly, has been one of the opportunistic investors that have gone into places like Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and all these countries that have had problems with the European debt crisis and bought up a lot of companies, assets, real estate. So I think the Europeans, yes, have definitely felt the downturn, probably more viscerally than the U.S. But U.S. companies are the big multinational companies, and they get about a third of their profits from emerging markets, the largest, of course, of which is China. Now, it's not just China's slowdown that affects those companies, but what China does to the rest of the emerging world, like Russia, Brazil, West Africa, all those countries have economies that are dependent on commodities and therefore on Chinese energy demand. And when China slows down, those countries slow down.
We have talked about the role that China plays as a global growth driver. And yet there's also an argument to be made, and you have made it, that one of the things Chinese growth did was disguise the fact that some big steps to shore up the global economy in the wake of 2008, 2009 haven't really been taken.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this entire market crisis that you've seen over the last few weeks is about the fact that we never really got a real solution to 2008. What we got is a genetically modified recovery. And it was genetically modified by the central banks of the world, by the Fed, as I was saying earlier, that dumped $4 trillion into the markets. that made them rise, obviously. It created a lot of easy money. That easy money went to emerging markets. It went in part to China. It buoyed those markets. But the structural changes that all these countries need to make, including China moving from being a place where cheap shoes get made to a place where you have a sophisticated service economy and people that spend on things that American companies make, that change hasn't really happened yet. America hasn't really moved on to a new growth model that isn't so dependent on debt. Debt's like energy. It doesn't go away. It just sort of moves places. So, you know, basically what it's done is it's moved off of company balance sheets and onto public balance sheets. The government has a lot of debt now. So nothing's really changed. And I think that until it does, volatility is going to be with us.
Rana Faruhar, columnist and assistant managing editor for Economics and Business at Time Magazine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Show, you heard Patty Hirsch reference commodity prices, and Rana Faruhar just gave us a global view. There is, of course, one commodity that lubricates deals and growth all around the world, and is, well, really cheap right now, and that is oil. Cheap oil changes policy, moves markets, and really affects people's lives. Scott Tong reports on the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, and he's been following oil's ride way up and now way down. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Lizzie.
It was not that long ago that we had conversations about oil, $100 a barrel and more, and now we're down in the 40s. What is going on? How'd we get here? How long are we going to be here?
Well, June, July of last year, we were at 110, and it was more than $4 at my house in Arlington, Virginia, and suddenly we had this plunge, right? So what happened? Well, the big event came on Thanksgiving Day of last year. That's when the OPEC producing nations got together and they said, we're going to change something. I mean, in the past, they've been what we call the swing producer. When there was too much supply in the market or not enough and prices were kind of going too high or too low, they would kind of make an adjustment to be kind of a shock absorber. If there was too much supply, they would kind of, you know, especially Saudi Arabia would, you know, take a voluntary timeout and stop drilling as much. And then prices would kind of moderate. And then on Thanksgiving, OPEC said, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore. And since then, we've had all of the producing countries, which now includes the U.S., going full bore, putting too much supply onto the market. So now we're swimming in oil. We have this glut right now. And since then, we've had demand, world demand, kind of pull off. Oil is a global market, especially in China, as they've been slowing down. And last couple of weeks, of course, we've had this China market overreaction, I guess.
Yeah.
So you have this kind of freak out thing to add on top of it, which pushed oil below $40 earlier this week, Lizzie.
We talked earlier in the show about the sort of connected nature of global markets, and oil is definitely one of those. So when we look at these low prices, what does this mean in the United States? It's not as if gas prices have plummeted.
Well, it's come down a little bit, but it doesn't fall as quickly as oil falls. Some people in the business say it rises like a rocket and it falls like a feather. And that's what we're seeing as far as gasoline. But still, if you know, I have a family of five. When I fill up or my wife fills up, you know, we have extra money to go out to dinner.
Yeah.
So certainly you have that effect on the American consumer. It's not shown up in a big way in GDP and other numbers, but that's still something. I mean, everyone who buys oil, right? Airlines, refineries, factories that buy oil to make plastics and chemicals and diapers. And if you work in all those industries that buy oil, this is a really good time. If you sell oil, you know, that's the opposite story. And oil's now drilled and fracked in a lot of places in the country. You know, it's not just Alaska and Texas.
Right, we're actually a producer in the United States.
We're one of the biggest producers. Yeah, North Dakota, Colorado, Ohio, You know, I remember about 4 years ago, I was down doing a story in Midland, Texas, in the Permian Basin, where they had, you know, the oil prices were over 100. And I met a couple guys at a rodeo with a couple trucks, and they had so much business hauling stuff for the oil business. And they were like, you know, right after this interview, we're going to go to the Bahamas. Life for those guys has really changed. And that's just the U.S. picture, Lizzie.
So if we look outside the U.S., who does this hit the most right now?
Venezuela is almost entirely dependent on exporting oil. They hardly make anything there. So there, they're really struggling. They don't sell enough oil to buy dollars to get any products on their shelves, so people line up all day to buy toilet paper. Russia is in recession. The Saudis are cutting back. They have to borrow more money because they're in deficit spending. And it's part of this broader commodity bust around the world, you know, all the commodities. So Australia, Mongolia, Brazil, everybody's is hurting here. So, you know, some people call this the resource curse. You get so addicted to revenue from selling commodities. And when the days are good, they're really good. And now we're seeing the other end of that.
Marketplace's Scott Tong on our sustainability desk. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Next week, we're going in depth on oil and its role in our lives and the global economy. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech, in real life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Welcome back, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
We're talking about uncertainty in today's show, and this kind of tracks with what you've been reporting on in the startup world, right?
That's right, Lizzie. This week, there's been a lot of uncertainty in the markets in recent days, the public markets, or at least volatility. And I've been talking to people about how that impacts the private equity world, so the world of startups and venture capitalists.
The people who put that money into startups, right?
That's right. And so let's set the scene a little bit. Public markets over the last several years, the startup world has been on kind of a crazy tear. There are 131 unicorns in the country. Unicorns, of course, are also known as startups valued at over $1 billion.
I actually did not know what a unicorn was. It was a term I'd heard tossed around, but startup valued at over $1 billion.
Over $1 billion. And 50 of those, or I guess 49 of those, are from this year alone. They've been valued at that. And in the first half of this year, venture capitalists, these people who invest in these private startups, invested $31 billion in private startups. So just like the public markets, the private equity world has been on an intense tear.
So when you think about that tear, how does uncertainty in the larger equity markets or bond markets that we see impact this private startup world that sounds like it's got a lot of cash behind it?
I think it impacts the startup world in a few different ways. For one, it's good to remember, of course, that the impact on the private startup world is usually delayed a little bit. The impact of market volatility isn't immediate in the private world. But what starts to happen is that people start being a little more careful with how they spend their money, right? That includes VCs, but it also includes the private companies themselves. You may have heard of the phrase burn rate.
How quickly a company spends its cash.
Exactly. How much and how fast startups are spending the investments they've raised from VCs. Over the last several years, as markets have been doing really well, startup companies have been really focused on growth. And to grow, you need to spend money. So a lot of companies have focused their spending there instead of spending resources on, say, you know, finding revenue for their great idea or finding a way to make money with their great idea. I talked to a guy named Curtis Lee this week. He's the CEO of a San Francisco-based startup called Lux. It's a sort of on-demand valet service for parking. And he had this to say.
As a startup, especially kind of a later stage startup, which we are, we always want to keep an eye out for our cash burn. What we're doing is just keeping our burn rate under control. You know, as we start to think about, you know, fundraising down the road, we're thinking about how that affects our fundraising process.
So he's like in this wait and see mode with his company. They've raised $20 million in their most recent funding round recently. And as private companies watch the markets, they are thinking about a near future where funding might be harder to find.
This is all really interesting stuff, but on the one hand, it does seem a little bit removed from the everyday existence of most people. Like, oh man, it might be hard for them to get another 20 million bucks. I'm going to cry my eyes out.
Right. The world outside of the unicorn world.
Right.
Yes.
Does this uncertainty in the startup world and in their kind of attempt to get VC funding, does that affect you and me?
I think there are a couple different ways that it can affect you and me, Lizzie. Now, one, we should note that a lot of people are being employed in this startup world. There are a lot of new entrepreneurs in the last 5 years that have come up with companies. They have hired a lot of coders, developers. A lot of people are really employed in the startup world, and this could impact them in pretty negative ways if this continues. Mm. Now, it's worth noting here that this isn't the dot-com bust by any stretch. Newer companies are better at making money than they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they do it in a wider spectrum of ways. It's not just website equals money, right? But what you might see from newer companies, they might stop offering services for free just to get you in the door. So you might see new services that ask you sooner to actually pay a little bit of scratch to use their service. And that actually isn't necessarily a bad thing for users.
It's just a very different marketing proposition.
Exactly. And it could be a good thing also for the long-term survival of the startups that really do want to make it long-term in an environment where it's harder to raise funding.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
When I woke up on Monday and it was clear that we were headed for a very uncertain week in the markets, I saw all kinds of messages online. People worried that their retirement accounts were vanishing, gallows humor tweets about negative 401ks, to which pretty much every financial advisor says something like, calm down, this is not 2008. And that's what you've been hearing throughout our show. We're going to bring on our personal finance expert and CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger for our version of the do not freak out speech. Hi, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Okay. So when the markets go nuts, what do you do when you can't, you know, predict the future?
Well, you know, it's so funny because it's when the markets go nuts, we say we can't predict the future. But when everything's calm, we think we can. We never can, right? So it's like, wow, it's this acknowledgement that we're all dopes and we're all emotional beings. I loved it. I spoke to a number of my friends in the hedge fund and trading world, and they just are always reminded that they too are mere human beings. They react emotionally, and it's scary. You know, it really can be scary, these very violent moves one way or the other. In many ways, I think being a regular old retirement investor or someone saving for my kids' education, I feel like it's easier for us because we don't have the pressure of trying to figure out where things are going in the next day or month.
Oh, wait a minute. Easier for us, maybe. But come on, there's a whole lot less that, you know, your normal person has. So a swing feels like it can really affect you. I mean, should you make changes to your 401k?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, obviously, let me take a step back. The reason why I think it's easier is that I don't think that we are putting the pressure on ourselves to try to figure out the next 5 days of where the market's going. Because I'm presuming that for most investors, people who have their 401ks or their 529 plans, that they've got a nice long time horizon. And I think one of the benefits of having a long time horizon is that you don't have to freak out when the market is swinging around so much, especially in this particular period of time. I think the financial crisis was different because it felt different. It felt like the world was melting down. But one of the things that's kind of cool is to remind yourself, well, you know what? These 10% corrections, these declines, they usually happen every year, year and a half. So it's 4 years since the last one. We were long overdue. And gosh, you know, it's not like I have to figure out what to do. I have to just figure out how to stick to my game plan. And I think that's the most challenging thing for retail investors. How do we stick to our game plan? How do we fight that emotional urge to do something when really what we should be doing is making sure that our asset allocation is where it's supposed to be and that we're not veering off track and trying to guess the bottom or the top of any cycle, near term, intermediate term, or long term?
Well, if you feel a need to do something, you know, if this motivates you in some way, is there something you should be doing or thinking about doing?
Well, look, I think if you really couldn't sleep for the last few days and you really got scared, my guess is you might have too much risk in your portfolio. Hmm. And just guessing. And I think that could be a wake-up call for you to look at it and say, you know what, the next 10% correction, I don't want to feel like this again. And perhaps I need to really adjust my asset allocation. Maybe I don't want to be 70% stocks and 30% cash and bonds. Maybe I really want to be more like a 50-50 investor. But there's a catch with that. If you're going to make that kind of big decision about your asset allocation, you're really going to alter your game plan. You got to make a pinky swear with yourself that you're not going to then trump yourself when the market goes the other direction so that you don't go back, you know, if we're 20% higher a year and a half from now, you don't go back and say, okay, I'm 70-30 now. Because one of the problems that we have as investors is that our emotions can actually pull us way off course. And I think that this is why research has shown, we have a company called Dalbar, and they do this interesting study. They say, what is the average stock mutual fund investor and exchange traded fund investor? How have they performed? And they look at 20-year rolling averages, and they found that through last year, the average return was 5.19%. Not terrible. 20 years, we had a couple of rotten times in there. But when you look at the index was returning 9.85%. So almost double.
Yeah.
And investors are lagging that stock index. Not because of big fees, which stink. We don't want you to pay big fees. But primarily, why are they lagging the index? Because they're jumping in and out of the market at the wrong times. We are shooting ourselves in the foot.
Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst, the host of Jill on Money, and a frequent guest on this show. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
Despite all the advice about playing the long game when it comes to the stock market, the first reaction a lot of us have when we see all that red is fear. Fear about retirement or your kid's college fund. We wanted to dissect that moment when your stomach drops, to understand it better, and also understand why some people react differently than others. David Zald studies fear, figures out what it is and why it makes us do what we do. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
You study fear. And I'm really curious what happens in our brains when fear hits. You know, that moment where there's a 1,000-point drop on the stock indexes. What's physically happening?
One of the things that's happening is areas in the brain, such as the amygdala and hypothalamus, start firing away, and they create multiple things going on at once. One is going to be the familiar subjective feeling that we get. A major part of it also is what happens physically. You know, that tension in the stomach, our eyes will basically go wide so we can take in any information that we need. Adrenaline starts pumping, and there is what we sometimes refer to as fight or flight responses. But even in situations where there's nothing to run away from, we're still geared up to act in those situations.
So we still sort of physically revert to, oh, my God, I've got to run away from here, even if there's nowhere to run?
Absolutely. And so if you're thinking about the investing, the quick response may be, I need to run away by pulling my money out, even though that's probably the exact wrong response to have if you're doing that after the drop has already occurred.
Which I know our personal finance experts all say is, you know, this is not what you want to do. But I'm curious, obviously, this affects people differently. If the colloquialism is fight or flight, that means that there are multiple things going on. How do different people process fear stimuli?
it really is going to be quite variable because it's going to be heavily determined by the person's sense of controllability. If they feel, for instance, that they can handle the situation, that may bring about a response where they want to fight it. Whereas if you say, there's no way I can handle this, then the flight is going to dominate for that. The other thing, though, is there are very different thresholds for triggering these responses, whereas some people will respond to even very minor provocations with a full-out, it's a disaster, it's a catastrophe sort of response. There are many others where you have to push it to a really high level before they start to respond so emotionally.
You're making me think about a friend's toddler who was this really brave little girl and waddled right into the ocean when she was, I don't know, 18 months old. Is this innate, or can you teach a higher tolerance for fear? Could you stick around a scary situation or a monetarily scary situation and get used to it?
People definitely can habituate. One of the things, though, that's also going to be important is what are the person's actual experiences? If they have lots of instances where things happen, but it's all okay, they may learn that they can handle it. Whereas if they just have some instances where everything goes wrong, they may end up with a very different mindset and a very different brain set in terms of how they interpret or respond to those situations. That being said, there is almost certainly some component of this, which is temperamental or genetic in origin, where people do seem to have some different biology that they are given and does influence some of those levels. And that's why you see, for instance, your friend's child who might seem quite fearless. Odds are they remain relatively more fearless than others in the long run, unless something happens to teach them otherwise.
So how does fear impact our decision making? I mean, I can think of this in a stock market sense. Someone who makes a bunch of risky bets that pay off might continue making them. Can fear make us ignore reality or be irrational?
Oh, absolutely. We can really take a look at decision making and find all these places where we routinely deviate from what is the most rational approach and take actions that end up being extremely harm avoidant, for instance, even when they're not actually the most practical decisions to make.
David Zald is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We're talking about insecurity this week, and we're going to end the show with a personal story about coming from one of the most isolated economies in the world to ours. And frankly, it's a story that put a lot of this week in perspective for me. Joseph Kim escaped North Korea when he was 15 by running across a frozen river to China. He now goes to college here in the U.S. I actually started our interview by asking him what he had for lunch, which is the question we usually ask to test someone's voice level. But his answer was so telling that we just kept it.
Growing up in North Korea, my father died of starvation when I was 12 years old. I became homeless around that age. The entire world and dream and everything was associated with food. But now that I came to the States, I just didn't realize that I hadn't eaten anything until today, like until you asked me what did I eat lunch. So I think it's very ironic that I didn't know I can forget to skip meals. The fact is that even at this moment, there are so many other North Korean boys and girls. Their dream is still to be able to have a full 3 meals a day. Yeah.
When you first came here, what was that like?
I didn't really have much expectations about America because, first of all, I didn't know the normal side of American growing up in North Korea. Only thing that I knew about America was the propaganda that I consumed from growing up in North Korea, which were examples as like when I was in kindergarten school, my teachers would take us to a room, a sort of a exhibit room where portrays the pictures or images of American soldiers stabbing pregnant North Korean women with their bayonets during Korean War, and put living people into gas chambers. So like all those negative images that I had, so I guess I was convinced that I would be safe and okay to go to America, because when I was seeking asylum in American consulate in China, the security guard, the bodyguards, they were like, sorry to say, but they're like white American, which I never met before.
What was that like when you met them?
It was just fascinating. I was like, whoa, like, it's like, wow, it's like their hair color is different and eyes much bigger than mine. But of course, like, I couldn't speak any English at the time, and the security guard, I don't think they're allowed to give anything to us, like candies or like the snacks they have. But, you know, they are human being too, like, even though they are soldiers, like, they would come to me and give me some, like, piece of pizza or, like, candy. There is no way he could communicate, like, what that is. So he would just, like, show his arm and the muscle and basically saying that if you eat this, it's, you're gonna be, your arm's gonna be, like, that big. In metaphorically, like saying it's good for your body. So I think that helped me break down that the negative and cold images of Americans.
Most North Koreans obviously do not have the chance to talk to someone like me. Do you worry at all about safety of people you love by doing this?
I actually thought about this. I would be lying if I say that I'm not worried. I am afraid and I'm scared. What hurt me the most is not so much about losing my life, but also people who invested in my life in the past years, and the people who loved me so dearly. I think that's what makes me sad the most. And of course, I do worry about my own life as well.
Coming as a teenage boy from a place where you were thinking about daily things like food, and now you're in college in the U.S., I wonder what you think about money, financial success, and what you think about American sort of obsession with it.
Now that I lived in the States, I think insecurity is probably what everyone struggles, whether you're rich or poor. More so with wealthy people, so I think they're more insecure
about you think so?
Their life. In the movies, like, I think you notice that the more richer you are, the more you're kind of slave to your entitled and money. And I understand. I mean, once you have that so much money and knowing that how helpful it is, in some sense, I do understand it can be very insecure to think about losing it all. But
and yet you don't seem angry at us or frustrated at us for taking so much for granted.
I wanted to be angry, but I also know it's not right thing to be, because I can't hate them because they worked hard to get that too. And also, it was not like they're like, oh, let me born in America. It was never their choice. So I can't really hate them or mad about it for being who they are. But I do want to, I would love to remind them that it's okay to not be like billionaires. Like, you still get to live.
Joseph Kim, thank you so much for talking to me.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're going to continue the conversation we had earlier about oil with an in-depth look at how it flows through our lives and around the world. How does it flow through yours? Come tell us at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.